This is Audible.
Listening Library presents The Midnight Star by Marie Lu. Read for you by Carla Corvo and Lannan Kalay.
I saw her once. She passed through our village, through fields littered with dead soldiers after her forces overwhelmed the nation of Dumor. Her other elites followed, and then rows of white-robed inquisitors wielding the white and silver banners of the White Wolf. Where they went, the sky dimmed and the ground cracked. The clouds gathered behind the army as if a creature alive, black and churning in fury, as if the goddess of death herself had come. She paused to look down at one of our dying soldiers. He trembled on the ground, but his eyes stayed on her. He spat something at her. She only stared back at him. I don't know what he saw in her expression, but his muscles tightened, his legs pushing against the dirt as he tried in vain to get away from her. Then the man started to scream. It is a sound I shall never forget as long as I live. She nodded to her rainmaker, and he descended from his horse to plunge a sword through the dying soldier. Her face did not change at all. She simply rode on. I never saw her again, but even now as an old man I remember her as clearly as if she were standing before me. She was ice personified. There was once a time when darkness shrouded the world, and the darkness had a queen. A witness's account of Queen Adelina's siege on the nation of Dumor, the village of Pondaterre, 28 Marzian, 1402.
Taranin, Dumor, the Sealands. Moritas was sealed in the underworld by the other gods, but Amari, the god of love, took pity on the young, dark-hearted goddess. He brought her gifts from the living world, rays of sunshine bundled in baskets, fresh rain in glass jars. Amari fell in love, as he was frequently wont to do, with Moritas, and his visits resulted in the births of Formidity and Caldora. An Exploration of Ancient and Modern Myths by Mordove Senia. Adelina Amuteru. I have had the same nightmare for the past month. Every night, without fail. I am asleep in my royal chambers at the Estensian Palace when a creaking sound wakes me. I sit up in bed and look around. Rain lashes the window panes. Violetta sleeps next to me, having crept into my chambers at the sound of the thunder, and under the blankets, her body is curled close at my side. I hear the creaking again. The door of my room is slightly ajar and slowly opening. Beyond it is something horrifying, a darkness full of claws and fangs, something I never see but always know is there. The silks I'm wearing turn unbearably cold, as if I am neck deep in a winter sea, and I cannot stop myself from trembling. I shake Violetta, but she does not stir. Then I jump out of bed and rush to close the door, but I can't. Whatever is on the other side is too strong. I turn to my sister. Help me! I call to her desperately. She still does not move, and I realize that she is not asleep, but dead. I startle awake, in the same bed and same chambers, with Violetta sleeping beside me. Just a nightmare, I tell myself. I lie there for a moment, trembling. Then I hear that creaking sound, and I see the door is starting to open once more. Again, I jump out of bed and rush to close it, shouting for Violetta. Again, I realize that my sister is dead. Again, I will bolt awake in bed and see the door opening. I will wake 100 times, lost in the madness of this nightmare, until the sunlight streaming through my windows finally burns the scene away. Even then, hours later, I cannot be sure I am not still in my dream. I am afraid that, one night, I will never wake, I will be doomed to rush to that door over and over again, running from a nightmare in which I am always, forever lost. A year ago, it would have been my sister, Violeta, writing at my side. Today, it is Sergio and my Inquisition. They are the same white-robed, ruthless army that Kenetra's always known, except, of course, they now serve me. When I glance back at them, all I see is a river of white, their pristine cloaks contrasted against the somber sky. I turn around in my saddle and return to gazing at the burned houses that go by as we ride. I look different from when I first took the throne. My hair has grown long again, silver as a sheet of shifting metal, and I no longer wear a mask or an illusion to hide the scarred side of my face. Instead, my hair is pulled back in a braided bun, jewels woven into the locks. My long, dark cape billows behind me and down my horse's quarters. My face is fully exposed. I want the people of Dumor to see their new queen. Finally, as we pass through an abandoned temple square, I find who I'm looking for. Maggiano had initially left me and the rest of my Kenetran troops right after we entered the city of Terranin, no doubt wandered off somewhere in search of leftover treasures from homes abandoned by fleeing citizens. It's a habit he picked up soon after I became queen, when I first turned my sights on the states and nations around Kenetra. As we approach, he rides through the empty square and slows his horse to a trot beside me. Sergio shoots him an annoyed look, although he says nothing. Maggiano just winks back. His mess of long braids is tied high on his head today, his menagerie of mismatched robes replaced with a gold breastplate and heavy cloak. His armor is ornate, dotted with gemstones, and if one didn't know better, one would assume at first glance that he was the ruler here. The pupils of his eyes are slitted, and his expression is lazy under the midday sun. An assortment of musical instruments is looped across his shoulders. Heavy bags clink at his horse's flanks. "You are all looking magnificent this morning," he calls out cheerfully to my inquisitors. They just bow their heads at his arrival. Everyone knows that openly showing any disrespect for Maggiano means instant death at my hands. I raise an eyebrow. "Treasure hunting?" I say. He gives me a teasing nod. "It took me all morning to cover one district of this city," he replies, his voice nonchalant, his fingers floating absently across the strings of a lute strapped in front of him. Even this small gesture sounds like a perfect chord. "We'd have to stay here for weeks for me to collect all of the valuables left behind. Just look at this. Never saw anything this finely crafted in Meritas, have you?" He edges his horse closer. Now I see, wrapped in cloth, in the front of his saddle, bunches of plants. Yellow thistle, blue daisies, a small, twisted blackroot. I recognize the plants immediately and suppress a small smile. Without saying a word, I untie my canteen from the side of my saddle and hand it to Maggiano so that the others don't see. Only Sergio notices, but he just looks away and guzzles water from his own bottle. Sergio has been complaining of thirst for weeks now. "You slept poorly last night," Maggiano murmurs as he gets to work, crushing the plants and mixing them into my water. I had been careful this morning to weave an illusion over the dark circles under my eyes, but Maggiano can always tell when I've had my nightmares. "I'll sleep better tonight after this." I motion at the drink he's preparing for me. "I found some black root," he says, handing my canteen back to me. "It grows like a weed here in Dumor. You should take another tonight if you want to keep the, well, them at bay." The voices. I hear them constantly now. Their chittering sounds like a cloud of noise right behind my ears, always present, never silent. They whisper at me when I wake in the morning and when I go to bed. Sometimes they speak nonsense. Other times they tell me violent stories. Right now, they are mocking me. How sweet, they sneer as Maggiano pulls his horse slightly away and goes back to plucking at his lute. He doesn't like us very much, does he? Always trying to keep us away from you. But you don't want us to leave, do you, Adelina? We are a part of you, birthed in your mind. And why would such a sweet boy love you anyway? Don't you see? He's trying to change who you are. Just like your sister. Do you even remember her? I grit my teeth and take a drink of my tonic. The herbs are bitter on my tongue, but I welcome the taste. I'm supposed to look the part of an invading queen today. I can't afford to have my illusions spinning out of control in front of my new subjects. Immediately, I feel the herbs working. The voices are muffled, as if they have been pushed farther back, and the rest of the world comes into sharper focus. Maggiano strums another chord. I've been thinking, me, Adelinetta, he continues in his usual light-hearted manner, that I've collected far too many lutes and trinkets and these delightful little sapphire coins. He pauses to turn around in his saddle and dig some gold from one of his heavy new satchels. He holds out a few coins with tiny blue jewels embedded in their centers, each one equivalent to 10 gold Kanetran talents. I laugh at him, and behind us, several inquisitors stir in surprise at the sound. Only Maggiano can coax joy out of me so easily. What's this? The great prince of thieves is suddenly overwhelmed by too much wealth? He shrugs. What am I going to do with 50 lutes and 10,000 sapphire coins? If I wear any more gold, I'll fall off my horse. Then his voice quiets a little. I was thinking you could dole it out to your new citizens instead. It doesn't have to be much, a few sapphire coins each, some handfuls of gold from your coffers. They're overflowing as it is, especially after Maritas fell to you. My good mood instantly sours and the voices in my head start up. He's telling you to buy the loyalty of your new citizens. Love can be purchased, didn't you know that? After all, you bought Maggiano's love. It is the only reason why he's still here with you, isn't it? I take another swig from my canteen and the voices fade a little again. You want me to show these Dumorians some kindness? I think it could reduce the frequency of attacks on you, yes. Maggiano stops playing his lute. There was the assassin in Maritas. Then we saw the beginning of that rebel group, the Saccharists, wasn't it? When your forces set foot in Damaca. They never got within a league of me. Still, they killed several of your inquisitors in the middle of the night, burned down your tents, stole your weapons, and you never found them. What about the incident in northern Tamora after you secured that territory? Which incident did you have in mind? I say, my voice growing clipped and cold. The intruder waiting in my tents? The explosion on board my ship? The dead marked boy left outside our camps? Those two. Maggiano replies, waving his hand in the air. But I was thinking about when you ignored the letters from the Tamoran royals, the Golden Triad. They offered you a truce, me, Adelinetta, their northern strip of terrain in exchange for releasing their prisoners and the return of the farmlands near their only major river. They offered you a very generous trade deal, and you sent their ambassador back bearing your crest dipped in the blood of their fallen soldiers. He gave me a pointed look. I seem to remember suggesting something subtler. I shake my head. We already argued about this when I initially arrived in Tamora, and I'm not about to debate it again. I'm not here to make friends. Our forces successfully conquered their northern territories regardless of their deals, and I will take the rest of Tamora next. Yes, at the cost of a third of your army. What will happen when you try to seize what remains of Tamora? When the bell does strike at you again? Queen Maeve is watching you, I'm sure. He takes a deep breath. Adelina, you're queen of the Sealands now. You've annexed Damaka and northern Tamora in the Sunlands. At some point, your goal should be not to conquer more territories, but to keep order in the territories you do have. And you won't achieve that by ordering your inquisitors to drag unmarked civilians out into the streets and brand them with a hot iron. You think me cruel? No. Maggiano hesitates for a long moment. Maybe a little. I'm not branding them because I am cruel, I say calmly. I'm doing it as a reminder of what they've done to us, to the marked. You're so quick to forget. I never forget, Maggiano replies. This time, there is a slight sharpness to his tone. His hand hovers near his side where his childhood wound continues to plague him. But branding the unmarked with your crest will not make them any more loyal to you. It makes them fear me. Fear works best with some love, Maggiano says. Show them that you can be terrifying yet generous. The gold bands in his braids clink. Let the people love you a little, mia Adelinetta. My first reaction is bitterness. Always love with this insufferable thief. I must appear strong in order to control my army. And the thought of handing out gold to the people who once burned the marked at the stake disgusts me. But Maggiano does have a point. On my other side, Sergio, my rainmaker, rides on without comment. The color of his skin looks pallid, and he seems like he still hasn't fully recovered from the chill he'd taken several weeks ago. But other than his silence and the way he wraps his cloak around his shoulders, even in this mild weather, he tries not to show it. I turn away from Maggiano and say nothing. He looks ahead too, but a smile plays at the corner of his lips. He can tell that I'm considering his suggestion. How does he read my thoughts so well? It irritates me even more. I'm at least grateful to him for not mentioning Violetta, for not confirming out loud that part of why I am sending my inquisitors to force the unmarked into the streets. He knows it is because I am searching. Searching for her. Why do you still want to find her? The whispers taunt me. Why? Why? It's a question they ask over and over again, and my answer is always the same. Because I decide when she can leave, not her. But no matter how many times I answer the whispers, they keep asking because they don't believe me. We've reached the inner districts of Terranen now, and although it looks deserted, Sergio's eyes stay focused on the buildings surrounding the main square. Lately, the insurgents, known as the Saccharists, taken from the Damakan word for anarchy, have attacked our troops on several occasions. It has left Sergio searching constantly for the hidden rebels. A tall archway leads into the main square, its stones engraved with an elaborate chain of the moons and their various shapes, their waxes and wanes. I pass under it with Sergio and Maggiano, then pause before a sea of Dumorian captives. My horse stamps the ground in impatience. I sit straighter and lift my chin, refusing to show my exhaustion. None of these Dumorians here are marked, of course. The ones in chains are those with no markings at all, the sort of people who used to throw rotten food at me and chant for my death. Now I lift a hand at Sergio and Maggiano. They guide their stallions away from me to stand at either end of the square facing the people. My inquisitors spread out too. Our captives shrink back at the sight of us all, their stares fixed hesitantly on me. It is so quiet that if I closed my eye, I could pretend that I am standing alone in this square. Still, I can feel the cloud of terror blanketing them, waves of their reluctance and uncertainty beating against my bones. The whispers in my head dart out like hungry snakes at scurrying mice, eager to feed on the fear. I nudge my stallion forward several steps. My gaze travels from the people up to the roofs of the square. Even now, I find myself searching instinctively for a sign of Enzo, crouched up there like he used to do. The pull between us, the tether that binds him to me and me to him, tenses, as if from somewhere over the seas, he knows that Dumor has fallen to my army. Good. I hope he senses my triumph. My attention turns back to the captives. People of Dumor, my voice rings out across the square. I am Queen Adelina Amuteru. I am your queen now. My gaze goes from one person to the next. You are all part of Kenetra and can consider yourselves Kenetran citizens. Be proud, for you belong to a nation that will soon rule all others. Our empire continues to grow, and you can grow along with it. From this day forth, you shall obey all laws of Kenetra. Calling a marked person a malfetto is punishable by death. Any abuse, harassment, or mistreatment of a marked person for any reason shall bring not only your own execution, but the execution of your entire family. Know this. The marked are marked by the hands of the gods. They are your masters and untouchable. In return for your loyalty, each of you will receive a gift of 5 Dumorian saftins and 50 gold Kenetran talents. People murmur in mild surprise, and when I look to my side, I see Maggiano glance at me in appreciation. Sergio jumps down from his horse and moves forward with a small team of his former mercenaries. They go through the crowd, picking out a person here and there, then drag them forward where Sergio forces them all to kneel before me. Fear washes over these chosen ones, as well it should. I peer down at them. As expected, all those chosen by Sergio and his team are strong, muscled men and women. They tremble, their heads lowered. You have the chance to join my army, I tell them. If you do, you will train with my captains. You will ride with me to the Sunlands and the Skylands. You will be armed, fed, and clothed, and your families will be looked after. To make my point, Maggiano descends from his stallion and approaches them. At each one, he makes a show of digging into his bag and dropping heavy satchels of gold Kenetran talents in front of them. The people only stare. One of them grabs his satchel so frantically that the coins tumble out, glittering in the light. If you refuse my offer, you and your family will be imprisoned. My tone deepens. I shall not tolerate potential rebels in my midst. Pledge your loyalty, and I will make sure that promise is worth your while. From the corner of my eye, I see Sergio stir uneasily. His eyes turn to the perimeter of the square. I stiffen. I've become very good at knowing when Sergio senses danger. He mutters to several of his men, and they head off into the shadows, disappearing behind a door. Do you pledge? Maggiano asks them. One by one, they answer without hesitation. I motion for them to rise, and a patrol of inquisitors comes to lead them away. More able-bodied men and women are brought before me. We repeat the same ritual with them. Then another group. An hour passes. Someone in one of the groups refuses to pledge. She spits at me, then calls me some name in Dumorian that I don't understand. I turn my glare on her, but she doesn't back down. Instead, she curls her lips. A defiant one. You want us to fear you, she growls at me, speaking now in accented Kenetran. You think that you can come here and destroy our homes, kill our loved ones, then make us grovel at your feet? You think we will sell you our souls for a few coins? She lifts her chin. but I am not afraid of you. Is that so? I tilt my head at her curiously. You should be. She challenges me with a smile. You can't even bring yourself to spill our blood. She nods in the direction of Sergio, who has already started to draw his sword. You have one of your lackeys do it for you. You're a coward queen, hiding behind your army. But you cannot crush our spirits beneath your rose's heels. You cannot win. At one time, I might have been intimidated by words like these, but now I just sigh. You see, Maggiano, this is what happens when I show kindness. So while the woman continues her speech, I swing down from my stallion. Sergio and Maggiano watch me in silence. The woman is still talking, even as I stop before her. The day will come when we strike you down, she's saying. Mark my words, we will haunt your nightmares. I clench my fists and fling an illusion of pain across her body. I am the nightmare. The woman's eyes bulge. She lets out a choked scream as she falls to the ground and claws at the dirt. Behind her, the entire crowd flinches in unison as eyes and heads turn away from the sight. The terror flowing from her feeds directly into me, and the voices in my head explode into shouts, filling my ears with their delight. Perfect. Keep going. Let the pain force her heart to beat so rapidly that it bursts. So I listen, my fists clenched tighter. I think back to the night when I'd taken my first life, when I'd stood over Dante's body. The woman convulses, her eyes flickering about wildly, seeing monsters that are not there. Crimson drops fly from her lips. I take a step back so that her blood doesn't reach the hem of my dress. At last, the woman freezes, falling unconscious. I calmly turn back to the rest of our captives who have become as still as statues. I could slice their terror with my knife. Anyone else? My voice echoes in the square. No? The silence lingers. I lean down. The bag of coins that Maggiano had originally thrown at the woman's feet now lies untouched next to her body. I pick the bag up delicately with two fingers. Then I walk back to my stallion and swing up into the saddle. As you can see, I keep my word, I call to the rest of the crowd. Do not take advantage of my generosity, and I will not take advantage of your weakness. I toss the woman's satchel of coins to the closest inquisitor. Chain her up and track down her family. My soldiers drag the woman away, and a new group is brought before me. This time, they each accept their gold quietly and bow their heads to me, and I nod my acceptance in return. The procedure continues without incident. If I've learned anything from my past and my present, it's the power of fear. You can give your subjects all the generosity in the world, and still they will demand more. But those who are afraid don't fight back. I know this well enough. The sun rises higher, and two more groups pledge their loyalty to my army. Suddenly, a sharp object glints in the light. My gaze darts up. A blade, a needle-like weapon hurled from the roofs. On instinct, I pull on my energy and whip an illusion of invisibility around myself. But I do not react quickly enough. A dagger flies right past my arm, slicing deep through my flesh. My body lurches back at the impact, and my invisibility flickers out. Shouts from the captives, then the sound of 100 swords scraping against sheaths as my inquisitors draw their weapons. Maggiano is at my side before I can even sense his presence. He reaches for me as I sway in my seat, but I wave him away. No. I manage to gasp out. I can't afford for these Dumorians to see me bleed. It's all they need to rise up. I wait for more arrows and daggers to rain from the roofs, but they don't. Instead, in the far corner of the square, Sergio and his men reappear. They drag 4-5 people between them. Saccharists. They're dressed in clothing the color of sand to blend in with the walls. My anger rises again, and the pain in my bleeding arm only fuels my energy. I don't wait for Sergio to bring them to me. I just lash out. I reach for the sky, weaving, using the fear in the crowd and the strength inside myself. The sky turns a strange, deep blue, then red. The people shrink away, screaming. Then I reach out for the rebels and send an illusion of suffocation around them. They hunch forward in the grips of Sergio's men, then arch their backs as they sense the air being pulled straight out of their lungs. I grit my teeth and strengthen the illusion. The air is not air at all, but water. You are drowning in the middle of this square, and there is no surface for you to breach. Sergio releases them. They fall to their knees, struggling to breathe and thrash on the ground. I expand my illusion, reaching out for the rest of the captives in the square. Then I lash out with all of my power. A net of pain blankets all of the captives still sitting on the ground. They shriek all at once, clawing at their skin as if hot pokers were burning them, yanking at their hair as if ants were crawling through the strands, biting at their scalps. I watch them suffer, letting my own pain become theirs until I finally wave the illusion away. Sobs rack the crowd. I don't dare reach up to clutch my own bleeding arm. Instead, I focus my hard stare on the people. "There," I say. "You have seen it for yourselves. I will tolerate nothing less than your loyalty." My heart pounds in my chest. "Betray me or any of my own, and I will make sure you beg for your death." I nod for my troops to come forward and round up the crying rebels. Only then, with the Inquisitor's white robes swirling around me, do I turn my stallion and ride out of the square. My roses follow. When I'm finally out of sight, I let my shoulders droop and descend from my mount. Maggiano catches me, and I lean against his chest. "Back to the tents," he murmurs, as he puts an arm around me. His expression is tense, full of an understanding that goes unspoken. You need to have that wound sewn up. I lean against him, drained after the sudden blood loss and whirlwind of illusions. Another assassination attempt. Someday, I may not be so lucky. The next time we enter a conquered city, they may ambush me before any of my roses can react fast enough. I am not Terran. My illusions cannot protect me from the cut of a blade. I will need to root out these insurgents before they can become a real threat. I will need to make a harsher example of their deaths. I will need to be more ruthless. This is my life now.
Raffaele Laurent Bessette. The sound of the surf outside reminds Raffaele of stormy nights at the Estensian harbor. Here in the Sunland nation of Tamora, though, there are no canals, no gondolas that have drifted away from their moorings to bob alongside the stone walls. There is only a beach of red and gold sand, and land dotted with low shrubs and sparse trees. High on a hill, a sprawling palace overlooks the ocean, its silhouette black in the night, its famous entrance illuminated by the glow of lanterns. Tonight, a warm early spring breeze comes in through the windows of one of the palace apartments, and the candles burn low. Enzo Valenciano sits on a gilded chair, his figure hunched over, his arms resting on his knees. Waves of his dark hair fall over his face, and his jaw is clenched tight. His eyes stay shut in pain, his cheeks moist with tears. Raffaele kneels before him, carefully undoing the white cloth bandages that run all the way up to the prince's elbows. The smell of burned flesh and cloyingly sweet ointment fills the room. Every time Raffaele pulls the bandage from a segment of Enzo's arm, tugging on the wounded skin as it goes, Enzo's jaw tightens. His shirt hangs loose, slick with sweat. Raffaele winds the bandages in a roll. He can sense the agony hovering over the prince, and the feeling scalds his own heart as surely as if he were wounded himself. Underneath the bandages, Enzo's arms are a mass of burns that never seem to heal. The original scars and wounds that had always covered the prince's hands have now spread upward, aggravated by his spectacular display during the battle against Adelina in the Estensian harbor. Destroying almost all of Queen Maeve's Beldish navy with fire has taken its toll. A piece of skin tears away with the bandages. Enzo utters a soft groan. Raffaele flinches at the sight of the charred flesh. "Do you want to rest for a moment?" he asks. "No," Enzo replies through clenched teeth. Raffaele obeys. Slowly, painstakingly, he removes the last of the bandages from Enzo's right arm. Both of the prince's arms are now exposed. Raffaele lets out a sigh, then reaches for the bowl of cool, clean water sitting beside him. He places the bowl in Enzo's lap. "Here," he says. "Soak." Enzo eases his arms into the cool water. He slowly exhales. They sit in silence for a while, letting the minutes drag on. Raffaele watches Enzo closely. Day by day, the prince has grown more withdrawn, his eyes turned frequently and longingly to the sea. There is a new energy in the air that Raffaele cannot quite put his finger on. "You still feel her pull?" Raffaele asks at last. Enzo nods. He turns instinctively toward the window again, in the direction of the ocean. Another long moment passes before he answers. "Some days, it is quiet," he says. "Not tonight." Raffaele waits for him to continue, but Enzo falls back into his deep silence again, his attention still on the ocean outside. Raffaele wonders whom Enzo is thinking about. It is not Adelina, but a girl long gone, from a happier time in his past. After a while, Raffaele takes the bowl of water away and gently dabs Enzo's arms dry, then applies a layer of ointment to the burned skin. It is an old salve that Raffaele used to request back at the Fortunata court, when Enzo would visit him at night to have his hands bandaged. Now the court is gone. Queen Maeve has returned to Beldane to lick her wounds and restore her navy, and the daggers have come here, to Temora, what is left of Temora, at any rate. Adelina's inquisitors dot the hills in northern Temora, holding strong. "Any news of Adelina?" Enzo asks as Raffaele reaches for a fresh set of bandages. "Dumor's capital has fallen to her army," Raffaele replies. "She rules all of the sea lands now." Enzo looks back to the sea, as if searching again for the eternal pull between him and the White Wolf, and his gaze seems very far away. "It won't be long before her attention returns here, to the rest of Temora," he says at last. "I wouldn't be surprised if her ships show up next at our borders," Raffaele agrees. "Will the Golden Triad meet us tomorrow?" "Yes," Raffaele glances up at the prince. "The Temoran royals say their army is still weakened from Adelina's last siege. They want to try negotiating with her again." Enzo gingerly moves the fingers of his left hand, then winces. "And what do you think of it?" "It will be a waste of time," Raffaele shakes his head. "Adelina turned down their last attempt without a moment's hesitation. There's nothing to barter. What can the royals offer her that she cannot simply take by force?" Silence falls over them again, perhaps the only answer to Raffaele's question. As Raffaele continues to wrap Enzo's arms in fresh bandages, he tries to ignore the waves outside. The sound of the sea beyond the window. A pair of candles burning bright in the darkness. A knock on the door. The memory comes unbidden and unrelenting, breaking through the walls Raffaele has put around his heart since Enzo's death and resurrection. He is no longer tending to the prince's wounds, but standing, waiting, frightened in his bedchamber at the Fortunata court years ago, looking out at a sea of masked people. It seemed as if the entire city had turned out for Raffaele's debut. Noblemen and noblewomen, their robes of Temoran silks and Kenetran lace, fanned out across the room, their faces all partially hidden behind colorful half-masks, their laughter mingling with the sounds of clinking glass and shuffling slippers. Other consorts moved amongst them, silent and graceful, serving drinks and dishes of iced grapes. Raffaele stood in the center of the room, a demure youth dressed and groomed to the height of perfection, his hair a curtain of dark satin, his gold and white robes flowing, black powder lining the rims of his jewel-toned eyes, staring out at a sea of curious bidders. He remembers how his hands trembled, how he'd pressed one against the other to steady them. He had been trained in the types of expressions to allow on his face, a thousand different subtleties of the lips and brows and cheeks and eyes, regardless of whether they reflected his actual emotions. So, in this moment, his expression had been one of serene calm, of shy allure and gentle joy, silent as snow, absent of his fear. Now and then, the energy seemed to shift in the room. Raffaele turned his head mechanically in its direction, unsure of what he was sensing. He thought at first that perhaps his mind was playing tricks on him, until he realized that the energy focused on a young stranger gliding between the crowds. Raffaele's eyes followed him, mesmerized by the power that seemed to travel in his wake. The bidding started high and spiraled higher. It soared until Raffaele could no longer make out the numbers, the sights and sounds around him beginning to blur. Other consorts whispered to one another in the audience. He had never heard such amounts tossed back and forth at an auction before, and the strangeness of it all made his heart pound faster, his hands shake harder. At this rate, he could never live up to the winner's payment. And then, as the bidding began to trickle down to a few, a young manservant hidden in the crowd doubled the highest offer. Raffaele's calm expression wavered for the first time as murmurs rippled through the room. The madam called again for an offer to top it, but none did. Raffaele stood in the silence, willing himself to remain still as the manservant won the auction. That evening, Raffaele lit a few candles with unsteady hands and then sat alone on the edge of his bed. The blankets were silken, trimmed with gold thread and lace, and the scent of night lilies lingered in the air. The minutes dragged on. He listened for the sound of footsteps approaching his chambers and repeated to himself lessons that older consorts had given him over the years. After what seemed like an eternity, he heard the sound he had been waiting for in the hall outside. Moments later, there was a soft knock on the door. "It will be all right," Raffaele whispered, unsure of the truth of these words. He got up and raised his voice. "Come in, please." A maid pushed the door open. Behind her, a masked young man walked into his chambers with the grace of a seasoned predator. The door closed behind him, right as he reached up to remove the mask from his face. Raffaele's eyes widened in surprise. This was the same stranger he'd noticed in the crowd. He realized, embarrassed, that the stranger was quite handsome. Dark curls of hair tied back into a low tail, long black lashes framing his eyes, scarlet slashes in his irises. He stood tall, and he did not smile. The energy Raffaele had sensed during the bidding now enveloped the stranger in layers. Fire. Flames. Ambition. Raffaele flushed. He knew he should be inviting the stranger to come closer, to sit on the bed. But in this moment, he couldn't think. The young man stepped forward. When he stopped before Raffaele, he folded his hands behind his back and nodded once. Raffaele felt the energy shift again, beckoning at him, and he couldn't help but return the stranger's gaze. Raffaele forced himself to give the young man a smile, one he had been trained to give for years. The stranger spoke first. "You noticed me in the crowd," he said. "I saw your eyes following me around the room. Why is that?" "I suppose I was drawn to you," Raffaele replied, turning his eyes down and letting the heat rise to his cheeks again. "What is your name, sir?" "Enzo Valenciano." The stranger's voice was soft and deep, silk hiding steel. Raffaele's eyes shot back up to him. Enzo Valenciano. Was that not the name of the disgraced prince of Kenetra? Only now, in the dim light of the chamber, did Raffaele realize that the boy's hair glinted with a hint of deep red, so deep it looked black. A marking. The former crown prince.
Your Highness,
Raffaele whispered, so startled that he didn't think to bow again. The young man nodded. And I'm afraid I have no intention of fulfilling your debut night. The scene evaporates as a knock sounds on the door. Raffaele and Enzo look over at it in unison, and Raffaele lets out a long breath, pushing the memory to the back of his mind as he puts down the bandages. Yes? He calls out.
Raffaele?
A timid voice answers.
It's me.
He folds his hands into his sleeves. Come in. The door opens, and Violetta steps hesitantly inside. Her eyes first meet Raffaele's, then dart to where Enzo sits with his elbows leaning against his knees.
I'm sorry to interrupt, she says. Raffaele, something strange is happening down by the shore. I thought you might want to have a look.
Raffaele listens with a frown. So, Violetta has sensed something ominous as well. She looks pale tonight, her olive skin ashen, her full lips pulled into a tight line, hair secured behind a Timoran wrap. She had found the daggers with her power almost a year ago, all on her own. It had taken her a week to find the words to tell Raffaele what had happened between her and her sister, then another week still before she begged them through her tears to find a way to help Adelina. Since then, she has stayed at Raffaele's side, working with him as he tested her alignments and taught her how to concentrate her ability to sense others' energy. She was a good student, a fantastic student. She reminds him so much of Adelina. If he let himself, Raffaele could imagine that he was staring at a younger version of the Queen of the Sealands, before she turned her back, before she was beyond help. The thought always saddened him. It is my fault, what Adelina has become. My fault that it is too late. Raffaele nods at Violetta. I'll come in a moment. Wait for me outside. As Violetta retreats to the hallway, he finishes bandaging Enzo's arms, then rubs his own neck in exhaustion. Too many nights in a row he's spent like this, weeks that stretched into months, all trying in vain to repair Enzo's wounds. But every time they began to heal, they would worsen again. Try to sleep, Raffaele tells him. Enzo doesn't respond. His face is drawn, pale from the pain. He is both here and not. How long ago was it that they had first lost him in the arena? 2 years? It seems a lifetime ago, eons since the last time Raffaele had seen his prince truly alive, the fire in him burning bright and scarlet. He does not want to give Enzo more reason to suffer right now, to let him know how much his presence, half in the living realm, half in the underworld, hurts those who love him. Instead, Raffaele walks to the door and quietly lets himself out. The night is warm, a prelude to sunland summers, and the heat from the day still lingers in the corridors. Raffaele and Violetta walk in silence under the lanterns, passing through the light and the shadows. At each door, he can sense the energy of every one of his daggers staying inside the apartments. Mikel, who after Gemma's death has locked himself away for days at a time, losing himself in his paintings. Lucent, whose chamber has a ripple of disturbance in it. Raffaele can sense that she is still awake, perhaps gazing out of her bedchamber window down at the shores. Lucent's bones have continued to hollow, and now she aches constantly, a development that has made her bitter and short-tempered. Maeve had stayed at first, begging Lucent to return to Beldane with her, even tried bribing and commanding her, but Lucent had refused. She would remain with the daggers and fight alongside them until her dying breath. After a while, Maeve was forced to lead her soldiers home, but the Beldish Queen's letters still arrive weekly, asking about Lucent's health, sometimes sending along herbs and medicines. Nothing has helped. Raffaele knows it will never help, for Lucent's illness is caused by something deep within her own energy. The last chamber once belonged to Leo, the bald boy whom Raffaele had recently recruited to the daggers, who had wielded the power to poison. Now the chamber sits empty. Leo died a month earlier. The doctor told Raffaele that it was because of a lingering lung infection. But Raffaele wonders about another possible reason. Because Leo's body had turned on itself, poisoning him from within. What weakness will soon manifest in him? I heard about Adelina's latest conquest, Violetta says when they finally reach the stairway leading out of the palace. Raffaele only nods. Violetta glances at him furtively. Do you think? How hard she tries. Raffaele can feel his heart reaching out to her, wishing to comfort her. But all he can do is take her hand and soothe her temporarily with a tug of her heartstrings. He shakes his head.
But I hear she is offering generous payments to the citizens of Dumor, Violetta replies. She's been more generous than she could be. Perhaps if we could only find a way to...
She is beyond help, Raffaele says softly, an answer he has given many times. He is not certain that he believes it, not entirely, but he cannot bear to raise Violetta's hopes only to see them crushed.
I'm sorry. We need to concentrate on defending Tamora against Adelina's next move. We must make a stand somewhere.
Violetta looks back toward the shoreline and nods.
Of course, she says, as if convincing herself.
She is not like the others. She aligns with Gems, of course, with fear, empathy, and joy. But she has no markings to speak of. Her ability to take away others' powers makes him uneasy. And yet, Raffaele cannot help feeling a bond with her, a comfort in knowing that she too can feel the world around her. None of the three moons nor any stars are visible tonight. Only clouds blanket the sky. Raffaele offers Violetta his arm as they pick their way carefully down the stony path. A hint of charge lingers in the warm winds, prickling his skin. As they make their way around the edge of the estate, the shore comes into view, a line of white foam crashing into black space. Now he senses what had troubled Violetta. Right along the shore where the sand turns cold and wet, the feeling is incredibly strong, as if all the strings in the world were pulled tight. The waves spray him with flecks of salt water. The night is so dark that they cannot make out any other details around them. Large, looming masses of rock lie nearby, nothing more than black silhouettes. Raffaele stares at them, feeling a sense of dread. There is a pungent scent in the air. Something is wrong.
There is death here, Violetta whispers, her hand quivering against Raffaele's arm.
When he looks at her, he notices that her eyes seem haunted, the same look she has whenever she talks about Adelina. Raffaele scans the horizon. Yes, something is very wrong, an unnatural energy permeating the air. There is so much of it, he cannot tell where it is coming from. His eyes settle on a dark patch far in the distance. He stares at it for a while. A series of lightning streaks breaks through the sky, carving trails from the clouds to the sea. Violetta flinches, waiting for the thunderclap to follow, but there is none, and the silence raises the hairs on the back of Raffaele's neck. Finally, after an eternity, a low rumble shakes the ground. His eyes travel down to the waves crashing along the shore, then stop again on the black silhouettes of rock. The lightning flashes again. This time the glow lights up the shore for a brief moment. Raffaele steps backward, taking in the sight. The black silhouettes are not rocks at all. They are Baliras, at least a dozen of them, beached and dead. Violetta's hands fly to her mouth. For a moment, all Raffaele can do is stay where he is. Many sailors told stories about where Baliras went when they died. Some said they would go far out into the open ocean, where they would swim lower and lower until they sank to the depths of the underworld. Others said they would leap out of the water and fly higher and higher, until they were swallowed up by the clouds. The occasional rib bone washed ashore, bleached white. But never had he seen a dead Balira in the flesh before. Certainly not like this.
Don't come closer, Raffaele whispers to Violetta.
The smell in the air grows more pungent as he draws near,
now unmistakably the smell of rotting flesh. As he reaches the first Balira, he extends a hand out toward it. He hesitates, then places his fingers gently against its body. The beast twitches once. This one is just an infant, and it is not dead yet. Raffaele's throat tightens, and tears fill his eyes. Something terrible killed these creatures. He can still feel the poisonous energy coursing through its veins, can sense its weakness as it takes another low, rasping gasp of air. Raffaele! Violetta calls out. When he looks over his shoulder, he sees her wading into the waves as they break against the beach. The hem of her dress is soaked, and she is quaking like a leaf. Get out of there, Raffaele wants to warn her. This feels like Adelina's energy, Violetta finally says. Raffaele takes a hesitant step toward the ocean, then another. He walks forward until his slippers sink into wet sand. He sucks his breath in sharply. The water is cold in a way that he has never felt before, cold like death. A thousand threads of energy tug at his feet as the water recedes, as if each one were barbed with tiny hooks, seeking a living being. It sends his skin crawling in the same way a rotting fruit filled with maggots would. The ocean is full of poison, deep and dark and vile. Beneath it churns a layer of energy that is furious and frightening, something he had only once felt in Adelina. He thinks of Enzo's strange distraction tonight, the faraway look in his half-alive eyes, the way he seemed drawn to the ocean. Raffaele remembers the storm that raged on the night when they'd brought Enzo back from the depths of the sea, where the edge of the living world ended and the world of the dead began. Beside him, Violetta remains frozen in place as the water sways against her legs. Raffaele takes a few more steps into the ocean until the waves come up to his waist. The cold water numbs him. He looks up again to where the silent lightning storm rages, and tears begin to spill down his cheeks. Indeed, this feels like Adelina's energy, like fear and fury. It is energy from another realm, threads from beneath the surface, an immortal place never meant to be disturbed. Raffaele trembles. Something is poisoning the world.
Even now, decades later, I fear nothing so much as the open ocean at night, with darkness stretching around me in every direction. The Journals of Rita Herrickin, translated by Bianca Berchetto. Adelina Amuteru. A full week later, the wound in my arm still throbs when I move too quickly. A thick layer of bandages covers it. I wince as I make my way down the ramp to the Estensian harbor, hoping I haven't broken open the skin again. The harbor today is filled with the stench of rotting fish. I wrinkle my nose as soldiers lead us to a series of carriages awaiting our arrival. Beside me, Sergio walks with one hand resting permanently on the hilt of his sword. He leans toward me. "Your Majesty," he says. The title flows as naturally from him as if I were born to the throne. "My men have captured several citizens accused of trying to breach the palace gates. They're in the Inquisition Tower now, but I'd rather not take any chances." I glance at him. And what are they so unhappy about? "Giving up their land to the marked, your new decree." "And what are you planning to do with those prisoners?" Sergio shrugs. He adjusts his cloak to wrap more snugly around his shoulders, then takes a long swig of water from his canteen. "Whatever you like, you're the queen." I wonder whether he thinks differently of me than he did of the Night King of Meritas. I'd like to believe Sergio respects me more than that. The Night King was weak, an enemy of the marked, a drunk and a fool. I pay Sergio far more than that man ever did. Sergio's armor is lined with threads of gold, his cloak woven from the finest, heaviest silks in the world, embroidered with the initials of their makers. The whispers laugh at me. "Watch your back, little wolf," they say. "Enemies arise from unexpected places." I push stubbornly, in vain, against their words. Sergio will stay loyal to me, just as Maggiano will. I have given them everything they could ever want. But you can't give them everything they want. They will always want more than they have. I remind myself to prepare another herbal drink once I'm inside the palace. My head has started to throb from their incessant noise, chattering away, echoing in my mind all throughout our journey home. Have them publicly executed, I reply, trying to drown out the whispers with my voice. Hanging, please. You know how I feel about burnings. Sergio, as usual, doesn't bat an eye. The Night King had commanded him to do much worse. Consider it done, Your Majesty. He waits as I duck into the carriage and then lowers his face close to mine. Stop by the dungeons when you arrive at the palace, he says. Why? I reply. A flicker of doubt crosses Sergio's face. I've gotten word from the keeper that something is wrong with Taryn. A prickling feeling runs down my spine. Sergio has never liked me visiting Taryn in the dungeons, so for him to